Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today. It's good to see so many folks out. As was mentioned, we're currently embarked upon a university speaking tour here in Australia that has already taken us to Brisbane and Adelaide, and we're back in Sydney now, and we'll be going on to Melbourne later. And we have really, really enjoyed it so much so far. We were prepared for terrible winter weather here, and you've greeted us with this warmth and sunshine as well as your hospitality, and so we've been having a wonderful time. Now, the question before us today is, did Jesus rise from the dead? And I'm going to explain why I answer yes to this question. There are at least two avenues to a knowledge of Jesus' historical resurrection: the existential and the historical. Now today I'm going to focus upon the historical case for Jesus' resurrection. I appreciate that the vast majority of Christians have not believed in the resurrection of Jesus on historical considerations, but rather on the basis of a personal encounter with the living Lord himself. And I think that this existential approach is fully legitimate. But I also think that a good case can be made for Jesus' resurrection historically as well. Now, one doesn't come to the study of Jesus' resurrection in a vacuum. So let me lay out very explicitly two presuppositions with which I approach the question today. First, I presuppose the existence of God, as demonstrated by the arguments of natural theology, such as the cosmological, teleological, axiological arguments. This was the approach taken by classical defenders of Jesus' resurrection, such as Hugo Grotius, Samuel Clarke, and William Paley, as well as by such contemporary scholars as Wolfhard Pannenbach, Richard Swinburne, and Stephen Davis. And it's the approach that I've adopted in my published work. Anyone who is an atheist or an agnostic obviously doesn't share this presupposition. Neither do pantheists, such as Buddhists and many Hindus. This is a huge difference, which will, of course, affect how you assess the competing explanations of the facts. But our time and topic are limited this morning, and so if we want to talk about evidence for the existence of God, we'll have to take that up during the question and answer time. Secondly, I presuppose that our background knowledge includes a good deal of information about the historical Jesus, including his radical personal claims, his teaching, and his crucifixion. In so doing, I stand squarely in the mainstream of contemporary New Testament scholarship concerning the historical Jesus. Again, I realize that Muslims, for example, do not share this presupposition. Most Muslims believe that Jesus proclaimed a simple message of monotheism and that he was not, in fact, crucified. This is a position, however, that is so extreme that it is not defended by any historian. To call it marginal would be an understatement. It doesn't even appear on the map of contemporary historical Jesus scholarship. So, I'm also situated very safely with respect to my second presupposition. Now, a historical case for Jesus' resurrection will involve two steps. One, there are three historical facts which any adequate historical hypothesis must account for. And these will include the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb, his postmortem appearances, the very origin of the disciples' belief in Jesus' resurrection. I think we're going to need to get the technicians at the back to advance these slides because mine isn't doing it. The origin of the disciples' belief in the resurrection. And then the second step will be inferring which explanation of the evidence is the best explanation. Now, with regard to that first step, the first thing that we need to do in order to conduct a historical investigation of Jesus is to assemble our sources. Jesus of Nazareth is referred to in a range of ancient sources, both inside and outside the New Testament, including Christian, Roman, and Jewish sources. Now, this is really quite extraordinary when you reflect on what a relatively obscure figure Jesus of Nazareth was, having at most had a three-year public life as an itinerant Galilean preacher. And yet we have far more information about Jesus than we do for most major figures of antiquity. The most important of these historical sources have been collected together into the New Testament. References to Jesus outside the New Testament tend to confirm what we read in the Gospels, but they don't really tell us anything new. And therefore, the focus of our investigation must be upon the documents found in the New Testament. Now, I find that many students don't understand this procedure. They think that if you examine the New Testament writings themselves, rather than look at sources outside the New Testament, then somehow you're reasoning in a circle, using the Bible to prove the Bible. If you even quote a passage out of the New Testament, they think that you're somehow begging the question, presupposing that the New Testament is reliable. But that's not at all what historians are doing when they examine the New Testament documents. They're not treating the Bible as a wholly inspired book and then trying to prove it's true by quoting it. Rather, they're treating the New Testament just like any other collection of ordinary ancient documents and investigating whether these documents are historically reliable. It's important to understand that originally there wasn't any such book called the New Testament. Rather, there were just these separate documents handed down out of the first century, things like the Gospel of Luke, the Gospel of John, the Acts of the Apostles, Paul's first letter to the church in Corinth, Greece, and so on. It wasn't until a couple of centuries later that the church collected these documents under one cover, which came to be known as the New Testament. The church included in the New Testament only the earliest sources, which were closest to Jesus and the original disciples, and they left out the later secondary accounts like the forged apocryphal gospels, which everybody knew were fakes. So, from the very nature of the case, the best historical sources were included in the New Testament. People who insist on looking only at evidence taken from writings outside the New Testament don't understand the historical method. They're demanding that we ignore the earliest primary sources about Jesus in favor of sources which are later derivative and less reliable, which is just mad as historical methodology. So, try not to think of the New Testament as a single book. Think of it as what it originally was, just a bunch of separate documents coming down to us out of the first century, telling this remarkable story about Jesus of Nazareth. And the question then must be, how reliable are these documents with respect to the fate of Jesus of Nazareth? Well, let's look at first at the evidence to be explained, and then we'll look at the best explanation of that evidence. It seems to me, as the result of my research, that the evidence establishes, as I say, three independent facts: Jesus' empty tomb, his post-mortem appearances, and the very origin of the disciples' belief in his resurrection. If these three facts can be established, and if no plausible naturalistic explanation can account for them, as well as the resurrection, then we're justified in inferring Jesus' resurrection as the best explanation of the facts. So, let's examine now the evidence supporting each one of these three facts. And let's turn first to the fact of the empty tomb. Here, I'll summarize five lines of evidence supporting the fact that the tomb of Jesus was found empty by a group of his women followers on the Sunday following his crucifixion. Number one, then, the historical reliability of the story of Jesus' burial supports the empty tomb. Now, you might ask, how does the fact of Jesus' burial prove that his tomb was found empty? Well, the answer is this. If the burial story is fundamentally reliable, that means that the location of Jesus' grave was known in Jerusalem to both Jew and Christian alike, since both were present when Jesus was laid in the tomb. But in that case, the tomb must have been empty when the disciples began to preach that Jesus was risen. Why? Well, first of all, the disciples themselves could not have believed in Jesus' resurrection if his corpse still lay in the tomb. It would have been wholly un-Jewish, not to say stupid, to believe that a man was raised from the dead when his body was known to still lie in the grave. Secondly, even if the disciples had proclaimed Jesus' resurrection despite his occupied tomb, scarcely anybody else would have believed them. One of the most remarkable facts about the early Christian movement is that the belief in Jesus' resurrection flourished in the very city where he was publicly crucified. So long as the people of Jerusalem even thought that Jesus' body was in the tomb, few would have been prepared to believe such nonsense as that Jesus had been raised from the dead. And thirdly, even had they so believed, the Jewish authorities would have exposed the whole affair simply by pointing to Jesus' occupied tomb, or perhaps even exhuming the body as decisive proof that Jesus had not been raised. And thus, if the story of Jesus' burial is historical, it's a very short inference to the fact of the empty tomb as well. And for that reason, critics who deny the fact of the empty tomb feel compelled to argue against the historicity of the burial story as well. Unfortunately for them, Jesus' burial in the tomb is one of the best established facts about the historical Jesus. According to the late John A.T. Robinson of Cambridge University, the burial of Jesus in the tomb is one of the earliest and best attested facts about Jesus. But if this conclusion is correct, then as I've explained, it's very difficult to deny the fact of the empty tomb. Number two, the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb is independently reported by early sources. So back up one from the women, and let's stay with number two. The empty tomb is multiply attested by very early sources. Mark's source for the story of Jesus' suffering and death, the so-called Passion story, probably didn't end with Jesus' burial, but with the women's discovery of his empty tomb. For the burial story and the empty tomb story are really one story, forming a smooth, continuous narrative. They're linked by grammatical and linguistic ties. Moreover, it seems unlikely that the early Christians would have circulated a story of Jesus' passion simply ending in his burial. The passion story is incomplete without victory at the end. And thus, Mark's source probably included and may have ended with the discovery of the empty tomb. Moreover, in his first letter to the church of Corinth, Paul quotes in chapter 15 from an extremely early tradition dating from within the first 5 years after Jesus' crucifixion. Here's what this tradition says, and I quote, "Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, and he was buried, and he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures, and he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Now, although Paul's tradition does not explicitly mention the empty tomb, when you compare this four-line formula that Paul quotes with the gospel narratives on the one hand and the sermons in the Acts of the Apostles on the other hand, it reveals that the third line, "and he was raised on the third day," is in fact a summary of the story of the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb. And thus we have independent, extraordinarily early evidence for the fact of Jesus' empty tomb. The discovery of Jesus' empty tomb cannot be written off as a later legendary development. But there's more. For once again, there are good reasons to discern independent sources for the empty tomb in the other Gospels and Acts. Matthew is clearly working with an independent source because he includes the story of the guard at the tomb, which is unique to his gospel. Moreover, his comment about how the rumor that the disciples had stolen Jesus' body has been spread among Jews to this day shows that Matthew is working with a prior tradition. Luke also has an independent source, for he tells the story, not found in Mark, of two disciples visiting the tomb in order to verify the women's report that Jesus was risen and the tomb was empty. This story cannot be regarded as Luke's own creation because the same incident is also independently reported in John. And again, given John's independence of the other three Gospels, we have yet another independent source of the empty tomb. Finally, in the sermons in the Acts of the Apostles, we again have indirect references to the empty tomb. For example, Peter draws the sharp contrast. David died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. But this Jesus, God raised up. Now, historians think that they have hit historical pay dirt when they have two independent accounts of the same event. But in the case of the empty tomb, we have no less than six, and some of these are among the earliest materials to be found in the New Testament. Number three, the tomb was probably discovered empty by women. In order to grasp this point, we need to understand two things about the place of women in Jewish society. First, women were not regarded as credible witnesses. This attitude toward the testimony of women is evident in the Jewish historian Josephus' description of the rules for admissible testimony. He says, "Let not the testimony of women be admitted on account of the levity and boldness of their sex." Now, no such regulation is to be found in the Bible. It is rather a reflection of the patriarchal society of first century Judaism. Secondly, women occupied a low rung on the Jewish social ladder. Compared to men, women were frankly second-class citizens. Consider these rabbinical texts. "Sooner let the words of the law be burnt than delivered to women." Or again, "Blessed is he whose children are male, but woe to him whose children are female." The daily prayer of every Jewish man included the blessing, "Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, who has not created me a Gentile, a slave, or a woman." So, given their low social status and inability to serve as legal witnesses, it's quite amazing that it is women who are the discoverers of and principal witnesses to the fact of the empty tomb. If the empty tomb story were a late developing legend, then certainly male disciples like Peter and John would have been made to be the ones who discover the empty tomb. The fact that women, whose testimony was deemed worthless, were the chief witnesses to the fact of the empty tomb can only be plausibly explained if, like it or not, they actually were the discoverers of the empty tomb, and the gospel writers faithfully record what for them was a very awkward and embarrassing fact. Point number four is that the empty tomb story is simple and lacks theological embellishment. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into that. Number five is that the earliest Jewish polemic presupposes the historicity of the empty tomb. And again, I'm going to skip over that point in the interest of time. Now, taken together, these five lines of evidence constitute a very powerful case that Jesus' tomb was in fact found empty on the first day of the week by a group of his women followers. As a historical fact, this seems to be well established. According to Jakob Kramer, who is a New Testament critic who has specialized in the study of the resurrection, and I quote, "By far, most scholars hold firmly to the biblical the reliability of the biblical statements about the empty tomb," end quote. In fact, in a survey of over 2,200 publications on the resurrection in English, French, and German since 1975, Gary Habermas found that 75% of scholars accepted the historicity of the discovery of Jesus' empty tomb. The evidence is so compelling that even a number of Jewish scholars, such as Pinchas Lapid and Geza Varmash, have declared themselves convinced on the basis of the evidence that Jesus' tomb was found empty. But there's more evidence to come. Now we come, secondly, to the fact of Jesus' post-mortem appearances. In 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 8, Paul writes that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brethren at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, then to all the apostles. Last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. Now this is a truly remarkable claim. We have here an indisputably authentic letter of a man personally acquainted with the first disciples, and he reports that they actually saw Jesus alive after his death. More than that, he says that he himself saw an appearance of Jesus. What are we to make of this claim? Did Jesus really appear to people alive after his death? Once again, time won't allow me to go into detail concerning all the evidence for Jesus' post-mortem appearances, but I'd like to look briefly at two main lines of evidence. Number one, Paul's list of eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrection appearances guarantees that such appearances occurred. In 1 Corinthians 15, Paul gives a list to Jesus' resurrection appearances of witnesses that is so early that to speak of legends would be irresponsible in such a case. Now, we can treat them as hallucinatory if we want to, but we cannot deny responsibly that these events occurred. These included appearances to Peter, or Cephas, the 12, the 500 brethren, and James. Paul's testimony makes it historically certain that various individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive after his death and burial. Secondly, the gospel accounts provide multiple independent reports of post-mortem appearances of Jesus. The Gospels independently report post-mortem appearances of Jesus, even some of the same appearances that are found on Paul's list. For example, the appearance to Peter is independently mentioned by both Paul and Luke and is universally recognized by critics. The appearance to the 12 is independently reported by Paul, Luke, and John, and is again not in dispute. The appearance to the women disciples is independently reported by Matthew and John, and enjoys as well ratification by the criterion of embarrassment, given the low credibility accorded to the testimony of women. It's generally agreed that the absence of this appearance from the list of appearances in the tradition quoted by Paul is a reflection precisely in the of the discomfort of citing female witnesses. Finally, that Jesus appeared to the disciples in Galilee is independently reported by Mark, Matthew, and John. From this evidence, what should we conclude? Well, even the skeptical German New Testament critic Gerd Ludemann is emphatic. He writes, "It may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ," end quote. The evidence makes it certain that on separate occasions, different individuals and groups of people had experiences of seeing Jesus alive after his death. Today, this conclusion is virtually undisputed among New Testament scholars. And so we come to number three, the fact of the origin of the Christian faith. The third fact to be explained is the very origin of the Christian faith. We all know that Christianity sprang into being sometime midway through the first century after Christ. Why did it come into existence? What caused this movement to begin? Even skeptical New Testament scholars recognize that the Christian faith owes its origin to the belief of the original disciples that God had raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. In fact, they pinned nearly everything on this belief. To take just one example, their belief that Jesus was the Messiah. Jews had no conception of a Messiah who, instead of triumphing over Israel's enemies, would be shamefully executed by them as a common criminal. Messiah was supposed to be a triumphant figure who would command the respect of Jew and Gentile alike, and who would establish the throne of David in Jerusalem. A Messiah who failed to deliver and to reign, who was publicly humiliated, defeated, and slain by his enemies, is a contradiction in terms. Nowhere do Jewish texts speak of such a Messiah. Therefore, it's difficult to overemphasize what a disaster the crucifixion was for these first disciples' faith. Jesus' death on the cross spelled the humiliating end for any hopes they had entertained that he was the Messiah. But the belief in the resurrection of Jesus reversed the catastrophe of the crucifixion. Because God had raised Jesus from the dead, he was seen to be Messiah after all. Thus, Peter proclaims in his sermon in Acts chapter 2, "This man God raised again. Let all the house of Israel know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Messiah, this Jesus whom you crucified." It was on the basis of his resurrection that the disciples could believe that Jesus was in fact the Messiah. It's no surprise then that the belief in Jesus' resurrection was universal in the early Christian church. The traditional formula quoted by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, in which the gospel is defined as the death, burial, resurrection, and appearances of Christ, shows that this understanding of the gospel goes right back to the very beginnings of this movement in Jerusalem. Thus, the origin of the Christian movement hinges upon the belief of these earliest disciples that God had raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. But the question is, how does one explain the origin of that belief? As R.H. Fuller says, even the most skeptical critic must posit some mysterious X to get the movement going. But what was that X? In summary, then, we're ready now to summarize all three of these facts. First, we saw that numerous lines of historical evidence proved that the tomb of Jesus was found empty by a group of his women followers. Second, we saw that several lines of historical evidence establish that on numerous occasions and in different places, various individuals and groups saw appearances of Jesus alive from the dead. And finally, third, we saw that the very origin of the Christian faith depends upon the belief of the earliest disciples that God had raised Jesus from the dead. One of the things that most astonished me after completing my doctoral studies in Munich on the resurrection of Jesus was the realization that these three great independently established facts represent the majority view of New Testament historians today. These are not the conclusions of conservative or evangelical scholarship. These are the conclusions of the broad mainstream of New Testament historical Jesus scholarship today. As we saw, three quarters of the scholars who have written on the subject accept the fact of the empty tomb. Virtually no one today denies that the earliest disciples experienced post-mortem appearances of Jesus, and far and away most scholars agree that the earliest disciples at least believed that God had raised Jesus from the dead. It's the critic who would deny any of these three facts that is today on the defensive. The remaining issue before us then is, how are these three facts that I've stated best to be explained? Well, we come now then to the second step in our case, which is determining which explanation of the evidence is the best. And I'm convinced that the best explanation of those three facts is the one that the original disciples themselves gave, that God raised Jesus from the dead. And I'll call this the resurrection hypothesis. Now, historians assess various factors in weighing competing hypotheses, and some of the most important are as follows. One, the best explanation will have greater explanatory scope than other explanations. That is to say, it will explain more of the evidence. Two, the best explanation will have greater explanatory power than other explanations. That is to say, it will make the evidence more probable. Three, the best explanation will be more plausible than other explanations. That is to say, it will fit better with true background beliefs. Four, the best explanation will be less contrived than other explanations. That is to say, it won't require adopting as many new beliefs for which we have no independent evidence. Five, the best explanation will be disconfirmed by fewer accepted beliefs than other explanations. That is to say, it won't conflict with as many accepted beliefs. And six, the best explanation will meet conditions 1 to 5 so much better than its rivals that there's little chance that one of the other explanations, after further investigation, will do better in meeting these conditions. So, How do naturalistic hypotheses stack up when assessed by these six criteria? Well, not very well, I think. I don't have time to go into this in detail this morning, as I have in my published work, but let me say that in all honesty, the only reason that the skeptic rejects the resurrection hypothesis, I think, is because of his aversion to miracles. But if God exists, as my argument presupposes, then how can you say justifiably that it's improbable that God would raise Jesus of Nazareth from the dead? The real question then, I think, is this: how open are you to the existence of God? In conclusion, therefore, three great independently established facts, the empty tomb, the resurrection appearances, and the origin of the Christian faith, all point to the same marvelous conclusion that God raised Jesus from the dead. The significance or the meaning of Jesus' resurrection will then be given by the religio-historical context in which that event occurred. It comes as the climax to Jesus' own unparalleled life and ministry and radical personal claims. If God has raised this man from the dead, who was crucified for allegedly having blasphemed against God, then God has publicly and unequivocally vindicated those allegedly blasphemous claims for which he was crucified. It gives us reason then to believe that Jesus was in fact who he claimed to be. Thank you very much.